Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're jumping into some really interesting source material you've shared with us today. Looks like a whole collection of your notes and research, all centered on supply-side policy and economics.
That's right. Yeah, this is a topic that really gets into how economies try to, well, grow their fundamental capacity, not just tinker with current spending. It's all about that supply foundation.
Exactly. So, okay, our mission today, based strictly on the documents you've provided, is to unpack what supply-side policy actually is, why governments might use it, the specific tools they employ.
Right.
And importantly, how your sources see its impact, especially using that ADA model. Mm. We're really sticking just to what's in these papers.
And it's super relevant, isn't it? Your notes make it clear this isn't, you know, just dry theory. It's about aiming for that long-run sustainable growth, better productivity, more jobs,
mm-hmm.
and trying to get there without kicking off loads of inflation. It's about expanding what an economy can do.
Okay, let's start right at the beginning then. Based on your sources, what's the fundamental definition we're working with here? What is supply-side policy?
Your materials are pretty direct on this. Fundamentally, it's about government actions specifically aimed at increasing the economy's productive potential. So increasing the quantity.
Okay.
And also the quality of the factors of production.
The classic land, labor, capital, entrepreneurship.
Exactly.
Those. Yes.
Improving them, making them more abundant or more effective.
And how does that show up in the big picture, like in those economic models?
Well, the main effect, the one your source really emphasizes, is shifting the economy's potential output line. In the ADAS model, that means pushing the long-run aggregate supply curve, the LRAS, to the right.
Ah, okay. So that rightward shift of LRAS is the graphical signature, sort of.
That's the key target, yes.
So this feels very different from demand-side policies, which are more about managing spending or shifting the AD curve, right?
Precisely. Demand-side policies often focus on smoothing out the business cycle in the shorter term, you know, influencing how much people and businesses are spending now.
Right.
Supply-side is playing a longer game. It's about increasing the economy's underlying ability to produce efficiently. Think of it like expanding the size and efficiency of the factory itself, not just managing orders for what the current factory makes.
And your notes mention there are even slightly different takes on that LRAS curve itself.
They do, yeah. They touch on the classical view where LRAS is vertical.
Meaning output is just determined by supply factors in the long run?
Essentially, yes. Independent of the price level in that view. Then there's the Keynesian perspective, which your notes also mention,
yeah,
where the LRAS might slope upwards initially.
Suggesting there's some spare capacity first.
Right. Acknowledging that maybe output can rise a bit without immediate inflation if the economy isn't running flat out.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, regardless of the exact shape they draw. Right. The point of supply-side policy in both frameworks is the same. Push that potential output level outwards. Shift LRAS right.
Got it. Okay, so expanding that potential is the name of the game. Why is this such a big deal for governments? What are the specific goals listed in your sources?
Your documents lay out several key objectives. A big one is boosting productivity.
Getting more bang for your buck, basically.
Exactly. More output per worker, per machine, per unit of input, making everything more efficient.
Okay. What else?
Another major goal is expanding the overall productive capacity. Just increasing the total amount the economy can sustainably produce.
Like lifting the economy's speed limit.
That's a good way to put it. And then there's reducing structural unemployment.
That's the tricky kind, the skills mismatch one.
Yeah, or when jobs are in one place and workers are in another, or their skills just don't line up with what's needed. Supply-side policies often aim to fix those underlying issues, maybe through training or improving mobility.
And it looks like there's an international angle, too.
Oh, absolutely. Improving international competitiveness is definitely listed. Making domestic industries stronger against global competition, helping exports.
Okay.
And finally, enhancing economic flexibility is mentioned, helping the economy adapt better and faster to changes or shocks.
What really jumps out from reading your notes is this idea that achieving these goals allows for growth without necessarily sparking inflation.
Yes, that's highlighted as a major potential benefit. If you increase the supply of goods and services the economy can produce, you ease the pressures that push prices up when demand grows. It allows for, hopefully, more stable growth.
Right. It tackles the bottleneck itself. Okay. So we get the what and the why. Let's dig into the how. According to your sources, what are the actual tools, the levers governments pull?
Your list covers quite a bit. First up is education and training.
Obvious importance, but how does it specifically link to the supply side in this framework?
Well, think of it as investing in human capital. Better education, better vocational training. It directly improves the quality of the labor force.
Makes workers more productive.
Exactly. More skilled workers means higher labor productivity.
Hmm.
That improves the quality aspect of the labor factor we talked about.
Okay.
And that shifts LRES, right?
Yeah.
Plus, as you hinted earlier, it helps tackle that structural unemployment by equipping people with the skills employers actually need. Makes the workforce more adaptable, too.
Okay, that makes sense. So improving labor, what about other factors, like physical infrastructure?
Huge one. Infrastructure development. Your notes mention investment in roads, rail, ports, digital networks, power grids, all that stuff.
How does better infrastructure help the supply side?
Well, it makes everything work more smoothly and cheaply. Moving goods, data, people, it becomes more efficient.
Lower costs for businesses.
Right. It reduces transport costs, communication costs. It helps businesses operate more effectively, connect markets better. This boosts the efficiency of capital and facilitates trade, expanding overall capacity. Again, LRES shifts right.
And what about encouraging new ideas, new tech?
That falls under research and development R&D incentives. Governments can use things like tax credits or grants to encourage firms, universities, whatever, to innovate.
How does R&D feed into supply?
New technologies usually lead to more efficient ways of producing things or entirely new valuable products. That boosts the productivity of both labor and capital. It keeps the economy competitive. Shifts LRAS right.
Taxes always seem to play a role. How do they fit the supply side picture according to your notes?
Tax reforms are definitely on the list. The argument presented is that, say, lower income taxes might incentivize people to work more hours or draw more people into the labor force. Increases the quantity of labor supplied.
Okay, the incentive effect.
Yeah. And lower corporation taxes are often aimed at encouraging businesses to invest more, buy new machinery, build new plants.
Boosting capital investment.
Right. Or encouraging entrepreneurship, starting new businesses. So that boosts the quantity of capital and enterprise. Your notes also mention taxes can be designed specifically to reward things like productivity gains.
Interesting. So taxes here are less about managing demand, more about shaping incentives on the supply side. What about rules and regulations?
Deregulation. That's another tool mentioned. The idea described in your source is that cutting back on complex rules, red tape, administrative burdens can lower costs for businesses.
Makes it easier to operate.
Yes. And potentially easier for new companies to enter the market and compete. More competition, the argument goes, pushes all firms to be more efficient, more innovative.
Which boosts overall potential.
That's the logic. Reduces barriers, encourages innovation, promotes competition, hopefully leading to more efficiency, and a rightward LRAS shift.
And the labor market itself can be directly targeted.
Huh. Labor market reforms.
Yeah.
Your notes list things like measures that might reduce trade union power, potentially allowing wages to be more flexible.
Okay.
Or simplifying hiring and firing regulations, which proponents argue could increase labor mobility. Also, encouraging flexible work patterns. The stated aim is more efficient, responsive labor market.
Privatization comes up a lot in these discussions, too. How's it framed in your source material?
It's listed. This is about transferring state-owned businesses to private ownership.
Right.
The rationale presented in your notes is basically that private companies, driven by the need to make profits and facing competition, tend to be more efficient and innovative than government-run ones.
So the profit motive drives efficiency.
That's the core argument. The shift to private ownership is expected to improve how resources are used in those sectors, boosting productivity and contributing to overall economic capacity.
Okay. And the last one on the list seems to be about international trade.
Trade liberalization, yeah. Reducing tariffs, quotas, other barriers to trade.
How does that help the domestic supply side?
Two main ways described. First, it exposes domestic firms to more international competition, which pressures them to become more efficient.
Adapt or, well, struggle.
Right. Second, it allows firms to import potentially cheaper or better quality components or machinery from abroad, lowering their costs and improving their own production. Both increase efficiency, resource allocation, productive capacity.
Yeah.
LRAS shifts right.
Okay, wow, that's quite a toolbox. So bringing it all together, how does the ADS model, as described in your sources, show the intended overall impact of successfully implementing these policies?
Right, let's visualize that ADS diagram from your notes. You start at some initial equilibrium where AD, SRAS, and the initial LRAS all intersect. That gives you your starting price level and output.
Okay, the status quo.
Then, these supply-side policies, if they work as intended over time,
they shift that LRAS curve.
Exactly. They push the LRAS curve to the right, signifying a larger potential output for the economy.
And what does that new intersection point look like? What's the outcome?
Well, the diagram in your notes shows that with LRAS shifted right to LRAS 1, the economy's potential output level is now higher. Assuming AD also grows over time, or even if it stays put for a bit, the economy can now reach a new long-run equilibrium with higher output.
More goods and services being produced.
Yes, and potentially higher employment, because the economy can sustain more activity. And here's the crucial part stressed in your material. This growth in output can happen with the price level remaining stable, or perhaps even falling slightly.
Because you haven't just boosted demand against a fixed capacity, you've expanded the capacity itself.
Precisely. You've eased the supply constraints. So you avoid the inflationary pressure that would normally come from, say, just stimulating demand. It allows for non-inflationary growth.
That's the theoretical payoff, then.
That's the core promise shown in the model.
Yeah.
Now, your source does add a nuance. These are long-run potential effects. In the short run, just shifting LRAS might not immediately boost output if aggregate demand is weak. You might need AD to catch up to utilize the new potential.
So it builds the potential, but you still need demand to realize it fully sometimes.
In the short term, possibly. But the fundamental goal is that long-term expansion of capacity and making the economy more resilient.
Okay, that paints a compelling picture from the model's perspective. But like anything in economics, your sources point out there are upsides and downsides, right? Let's get into that balanced view. What are the main advantages highlighted?
Sure. The main upsides listed are achieving sustainable economic growth in the long run, helping to keep inflation under control by boosting supply, specifically targeting and potentially reducing that difficult structural unemployment, improving the country's international competitiveness, and creating a more flexible, adaptable economy overall.
Those definitely sound like worthwhile goals. But what about the challenges or drawbacks that your sources mentioned?
Yes, the notes are clear about the downsides, too. A major one is the time lag.
These things don't happen overnight.
Not at all. Education reforms, big infrastructure projects, their full effects might not be felt for years, maybe even decades. Requires real patience.
Okay, so long horizons. What else?
High initial costs. Investing heavily in education, infrastructure, R&D that takes serious money up front, can be a strain on government budgets.
Right, you have to pay for it now for benefits later.
Exactly. Third, there's uncertainty. You can't guarantee every policy will actually deliver the expected boost in productivity or efficiency. Measuring the impact is tricky too.
So it's not a magic bullet.
Definitely not presented as one. Fourth, your notes mention potential risks for inequality.
How so?
Well, things like deregulation or privatization, while potentially boosting overall efficiency, might lead to job losses in some areas, or the benefits might flow more towards, say, owners of capital or higher skilled workers, widening income gaps.
Okay, that's a significant concern.
It is. And finally, political resistance. Making changes to labor laws, cutting business taxes, privatizing state assets. These can be really controversial and face strong opposition from unions, parts of the public, or political opponents.
Makes sense. You're often changing long-established ways of doing things.
Absolutely. So the sources suggest that while the aim is long-term gain, the path there involves significant costs, delays, uncertainties, and navigating tricky political waters.
Okay, so wrapping up this deep dive then, pulling together everything from your source material, supply-side policies are presented as this really critical long-term strategy. The focus is squarely on improving the economy's fundamental capacity, its efficiency.
Yes, aiming for that sustainable, non-inflationary growth by working on the structure of the economy itself, not just managing demand cycles.
But it's clear from your notes, they aren't simple fixes. They need careful design, major investment.
And a whole lot of patience, because those benefits, as we saw, can take a long time to show up.
It really does leave you pondering, based on all this. Given those significant time lags, the upfront costs, the uncertainties we just talked about, how do policymakers effectively balance the immediate pressures they always face? You know, and maybe a recession looming or needing to respond to a crisis now with this kind of long-term patient investment needed for supply-side reforms. And what does that tension tell us about the real-world political hurdles, the challenges of actually implementing these policies and sticking with them long enough for them to potentially bear fruit?